Welcome everyone to the LaRue Show for Saturday, May 10, 2014. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I welcome you all. We're actually pre-taping this for scheduling reasons on May 9th, and you know May 7th, 8th, and 9th, depending on where you are in the world, is VE Day, Victory in Europe, from 1945. And in many ways, this does bear on our topic today, which we set as the threat of nuclear war. It's not Ukraine. Now, I'm glad we have with us here live my a colleague of mine, Tony Papert, in the studio. Welcome, Tony.
Hi.
And Tony, who's been on before, of course, is on the Editorial Board of Executive Intelligence Review, EIR Online. He is working in particular right now in to prepare and make available in a few days or even shorter a new strategic piece by Mr. Lyndon LaRouche that's a companion piece for a fact sheet that's still in the works about, in fact, the nature of the regime now in Ukraine, which includes neo-Nazis, includes literally those who belong to a continuous line going back to the Second World War. Tony can tell more, maybe before, when in fact, at the end of the war in 1945, the world had the profound slogan, never again, never war again, never fascism, never mass death again. And yet here we are in the situation where this is what we face. We have brinkmanship underway. As we said, it's not just in Ukraine, and it's not just geographically in other parts of the world, which it is in Asia. But these aren't the specific, immediate, proximate cause of it. We have forces who are deliberately doing this. Now, unless Tony knows differently, I think the title Mr. LaRouche is working under is something like History is Closing in on Obama, and his subtitle is The Way History Closes in on the Past, and that's the kind of thing I'm getting here.
And I think it'll be up on the LaRouche Pack site by tonight.
Oh, great. And as I said, the fact sheet is in the works. And let me just say a few things in advance, and then Tony can introduce the point of or the discussion of what are the forces behind this. And namely, most of our regular listeners who are also activists know it's best called the British Empire. It's imperial. We're not talking about the people or kingdom even of the British Isles. We're talking about an imperium here pushing for this. And but what I'd like to do is something that amounts to putting the cart before the horse on this hour-long discussion. Rather than bring out certain need-to-know concepts in the course of the discussion, which Tony will do, I want to talk about how we're making out in activating to stop this and just report on a few things from Washington, D.C., because, as I say, a lot of you regulars listening in, even collaborators abroad, know that we want this to stop. And I will say, this fact sheet I just mentioned about the neo-Nazi nature of this regime that was installed in Kiev by filthy operations coming out of London using Obama and the State Department and other elements in the transatlantic, we put out a fact sheet in February, I think, on this, quickly as a blitz, because the media lies, the lie, official lies out of the White House and the State Department, the lies out of David Cameron and Whitehall in Britain and elsewhere were so horrendous, but many people didn't know what would truly, maybe they should have, but didn't know. People in Congress, other leaders, concerned citizens in the United States and elsewhere didn't know. But now, after these months, they have no excuse. But what I want to say is we have been, the truth is being forced out. The impact is significant, that more people in institutions as well as Congress are seeing that Obama's a patsy for this kind of war-threatening, war-provoking policy, and he should be put out of office. Now, in specific, yesterday, in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, a leading activist of the attempt to provoke war, Victoria Nuland, who's I think a deputy or an undersecretary
Assistant Secretary of State for Europe.
That's it. And she was confronted and specifically questioned, I'm going to read the quotes in just a minute, about the neo-Nazi nature of this regime. Of course, she lied. But the point is that might not have happened some months ago. There's less and less place to hide. Obama is being boxed in. History's closing in on him. And that's the situation we have. But let me, before I read those quotes, I just want to say that all the activation around the nation, but it's been going on in tandem with what's happening in Washington, D.C. So in the past week, the first full week of May, there were delegations on Capitol Hill from the mid-Atlantic states, from New Jersey, New York, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, joining all the regular team from the LaRouche Political LPAC and others. And on May 6th, on Capitol Hill was a big banner rally. The banner said, "It's the British Empire, stupid." And a statement to that effect and other things went out. The next day or the day after was another banner. It said, "Obama backs Nazism in Ukraine. Impeach Obama before he starts world war." And in New York City, May 6th also, a whole grouping from the New York, New Jersey area staged a very punchy protest rally, not mere protest, an informational rally in front of the New York Times. And I think it was a huge banner that said enough is enough because of the lies of the New York Times and then and now. But in particular, there was a famous old slogan, if you go back far enough, of the New York Times to advertise its classified ad section where you look for a job. And it said, "I got my job through the New York Times." So that a banner with three large photographs of Hitler, Mussolini, and this woman, Victoria Nuland, was there in front of the New York Times. Now, many people stopped in all of these cases, Capitol Hill in Manhattan, and said, it makes sense. There was a huge map that went with "It's the British Empire, stupid," showing the map of the world, where the Commonwealth is, where hotspots are being deliberately stoked by the British Empire, and so forth. You can find that on the LaRouche PAC website. So you had a situation, this shows the kind of nature of activation. And so let me just, before we go to Tony, say in specific what happened to Victoria Nuland yesterday in the House of Representatives. She also had spoken in the Senate 2 days earlier, and she specialized in lies of the nature of snow is black. Black is white and snow is black. So a Republican and Democrat member of the Foreign Affairs Committee from California, Dana Rohrabacher, he's the Republican, Brad Sherman is the Democrat. They were very specific. Dana Rohrabacher said to Victoria Nuland, he said, regarding Ukraine, he said, the president there had been put in office by a legitimate election. But then President Yanukovych was removed in violence. There are pictures of neo-Nazis. Were the neo-Nazis involved in street violence? Nuland. The vast majority were peaceful protesters. We saw firebombs being thrown and people shooting into police ranks. All of these incidents are subject to investigation. Rohrabacher came back, but guns were involved. Nuland. Well, as the demonstrations became more violent, and then Rohrabacher, was the neo-Nazi group affiliated with Nazi groups in other countries? Which is true. She said, I don't know about the early period. Then she said, later we see recruiting on neo-Nazi websites in Russia. So in other words, and she went on, she's to blame Russia. We don't have any information against neo-Nazi groups from Europe. There is no information to corroborate. Ukraine is investigating. Then Brad Sherman, another representative, a Democrat, broke in. And he picked up on her having said that Russia is recruiting neo-Nazis and said, He said, there's an anti-Russian bias of U.S. foreign policy in various cases of U.S. support. And he said, there are, he said, South Sudan, South Ossetia, Moldova, and other cases. And Representative Sherman said, this seems haphazard. He says, quote, every decision we make is anti-Moscow. So I can, then he asked specifically, let me just continue, Tony, with just this. Sherman said, has the right sector militia been disarmed? And I'll tell, I think, listeners, no, this is absolutely a neo-Nazi element, and it's in the government. Newland says, Ukraine has made a massive effort. He broke in. How successful has it been? Newland, there's progress, but more to do. Sherman, Kiev wants to repeal the Russian language law. Newland, language rights will be protected. And it went on. So I just want to say, this information, we're not in an information exchange here. It's, Mr. LaRouche put it colloquially in a May 2nd webcast. He said, we have to stop the war people. There are war people there. That's what we're looking at in the world today. And that's what our job is. And Tony, that's when, let me turn it over to you. Because in a way, you could say, who's the real enemy of the United States here? We keep being told it's Putin, it's Russia, it's the, but we're up against it here. The war danger is very real. We are closing in on it, and so I'm glad you're here today. So you can take it either from now or historically, what you want to, how you want to begin.
Well, let's go just a little bit more into the immediate situation you discussed. There's a deliberate attempt going on. It's clear to anybody who puts it together to taunt Putin into waging some sort of ill-advised war or invasion of Ukraine, for example, to taunt him into doing this by use of actual Nazis, just as Marcia has implied. And this is fully laid out in the fact sheet on the LaRouche Pack website. We'll have more to say about it, but it's completely laid out there that you have actual Nazi organizations implanted in Ukraine by Adolf Hitler, by the SS under him, which have survived to the present day, in many cases through actually the grandchildren, in some cases the children, but more often the grandchildren, of the people who actually worked for the Nazis in Ukraine during World War II. And that these organizations have been unleashed to form a so-called government of Ukraine today, supposedly under supposed President Turchynov and supposed Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, which is actually controlled by Nazi organizations. The fastest way to put the common denominator, there's a lot more can be said about it, which I think I won't say here, but the common denominator of all the organizations, which they don't comprise a technical majority of the current government, but since they have weapons and they're free to use them in any way they want, they control the rest of the government, which doesn't consist of actual Nazis. So the common denominator, as I said, of all of them is Stepan Bandera, who was a Ukrainian who functioned as part of the Hitler machine in Ukraine during World War II, and whose organization, the OUNB, the UPA, two of his organizations, he had other organizations, his organizations were involved along with, side by side with Germans and other Axis soldiers in crimes against humanity and genocide against Jews and Poles and some say Russians, but clearly documented Jews and Poles in Ukraine of that day. And the armed demonstrators of the Maidan, who were sponsored by the likes of Victoria Nuland, whom Marcia discussed, to take over the government, an illegal coup, these armed demonstrators were Banderas. They were followers of Stepan Bandera with his slogans, his symbols, the Nazi wolf hook or wolf angle symbol, also the white supremacy symbols from the Ku Klux Klan, the Confederate flag. They were his self-declared followers who today run the government of Ukraine. last Friday, and I tell you also, when we were in Congress over this week, we were shocked to find that many of our congressmen weren't aware of this. But last Friday, 1 week ago today, we're recording on Friday, these Nazis herded a bunch of their opponents into a trade union building in Odessa and set the thing on fire, and with the people in it, and kept firing at the windows and windowsills and doors to make sure they couldn't escape. And what was released by the coup-installed Ukrainian interior minister last Friday was that 38 people had been burned to death in there. But now the figures are changing, and it looks like it's many tens more than 38 that were burnt to death by genuine Nazis under the nose and sponsored by Victoria Nuland. So, but Obama is merely a hapless puppet in this. He hardly even knows what's going on. I mean, as you see, the actual affair is being, although Obama fronts for it, takes the blame for it, is the public representative for it, the actual shots are being called by this coven of witches which surround Obama and tell him what to think. Victoria Nuland was mentioned, Susan Rice, Samantha Power, Michelle Obama is also part of the same thing.
Valerie Jarrett
is.
And they shade into, I think Nancy Ann DeParle may have left and she may be called healthcare, but you got a lot of them, right?
Yeah, it's a bunch of witches, a witches coven, which surrounds Obama and tells him what to think. So he's simply a puppet, and the orders for this come from London. And that we'll discuss in some length, and I'm sure many of our listeners are aware of it. But if you go to the website of the RIIA, otherwise known as Chatham House, C-H-A-T-H-A-M House, in London, you'll see the writings of their chief Ukraine specialist. At least he's the one who's doing the writing for them on Ukraine right now. I forget his first name, maybe James, but his last name is L-O-U-G-H, maybe Lau. What he says there very explicitly is that there are the following different ways, which he lists, that we can use these Nazis we control to taunt Putin, is Lyndon LaRouche's way of saying it, to force Putin against his will, they hope, to engage in war in a way that would be disadvantageous so that Russia could be destroyed. Putin, it seems Putin is smart enough not to do that. But as Marcia said, we have now, from the Obama circle on orders from London, which they don't even necessarily fully understand the orders they're getting, but from the Obama circle on orders from London, we're driving toward a war confrontation between the two biggest nuclear powers, the U.S. and Russia. All the time during those decades of the Cold War, we never came as close to thermonuclear war as we are now, deliberately. I mean, the people we had in control, for all that they were crazy, we're not as crazy as the ones we have there now. So we never came anywhere near as close to thermonuclear war with Russia as we are now. And this, the White House circle that we've described is still moving for thermonuclear war. And that's the point of Nuland's testimony, that they're not going to retreat. They're going to keep pushing these things. And what the guys from London who are calling the shots is saying, keep pushing it, keep pushing it. Eventually we'll shame Putin. We're roasting his people to death in public, having registered Nazis doing it. Eventually, we'll shame him into going to war in a situation where Russia will be at a disadvantage and will destroy them. So they think we'll destroy them, although it's at least equally likely that everybody in the world will be destroyed pretty quickly in world thermonuclear war. But I wanted to step, so that's the immediate situation in one way of saying it, but I just wanted to step back from it a little bit, because most Americans, as listeners know, most Americans are pretty much in la-la land, like the congressman, and they just have no idea of the situation they're living in today's world. What is really going on? What is the backdrop for all these, for what is the backdrop for the drive for thermonuclear war? Because it's not a drive for as the title of Lyndon LaRouche's paper, I think, implies in the title for this show. The issue of thermonuclear war is not Ukraine. The issue is that London is pushing for war, for world domination, even if it means the risk of an all-out thermonuclear war, which will destroy everybody, which is the most likely prospect by far if they get the war they want. And you see this, therefore, I mean, you see this not only in Europe, and, I mean, the so-called response, again, just going back to Europe for a minute, the so-called Washington response to what they call Russia's aggression in Ukraine, which is not really aggression at all, but their so-called response is to put out of area U.S., British and French and other NATO troops on Russia's borders. So their response to what they falsely claim is a crisis of Russian aggression in Ukraine is to move toward war with Russia, not merely in Ukraine, but all along the European borders of Russia. That's not the limit of it. The same thing is going on in Asia. I mean, to go into this in all detail would take longer than the hour we have, but the Obama administration's plans underway now are to have more than half of the entire U.S. Navy offshore of China. That's what they're moving toward. The United States, I mean, Obama just took an Asian tour. What he did was meet with China's neighbors and offer them U.S. military support to engage against China on various border issues, mostly uninhabited islands, issues which have been left in abeyance for years or even centuries, and which could be left in abeyance for years or centuries in the future, were it not for the same White House witches brew around Obama, insisting on making them into active conflicts and involving the U.S. military in Asian, obscure Asian territorial disputes. And this just came to a flashpoint in the case of Vietnam yesterday, as again, listeners may know, thanks to U.S. pushing of territorial issues of Vietnam against China, the Philippines against China, and other neighboring nations against China.
Yeah, and people will remember, but just to remind ourselves, Obama toured the Southern Pacific. Australia has this buildup now, the New Deal with the Philippines. And I understand Japanese President Abe was recently, or maybe yesterday, in meetings with NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, lest we forget. Now the Pacific, so the whole geography of the world is turned inside out.
North Atlantic, North Pacific. Yeah, that's correct. Abe met officially with NATO and declared solidarity with NATO and declared that Chinese moves in the Pacific are equivalent to the so-called Russian aggression in Ukraine. So that therefore he stands in solidarity with NATO. It's an insane situation. Now, but just step way, way back for a minute, because I mean, to deal with this adequately, we have to have a better idea of where it comes from than most people have. As I say, most Americans are really in la-la land, and they have no idea what are the circumstances in which they're living overall here now in 2014 in the U.S. And the place I think we should begin is that we're in another historic dark age, a dark age of an eclipse of culture, civilization, science, and also economy. We're in a dark age of the decline and fall of empire in such a way that the empire is declining and falling and collapsing. But it's declining and falling and collapsing on top of the heads of the people who live there, who are in process of being exterminated. So the The Dark Age period, which people are probably most familiar with, is the 14th century New Dark Age in Europe, of the collapse of the Venetian Empire. And the Venetian Empire collapsed is in a way very similar to the present London Empire, which is characterized by Wall Street and the city of London and financial crimes worldwide of the type of Wall Street, the city of London, Paris, Frankfurt, and so on. So the Venetians had this going in a big way in the 14th century. And they had the Kingdom of England in hock to the point that all the sheep in England were in hock to the Venetian bankers.
I used to live in the west of England. This was a very big deal, even to this century.
So one fine day, Edward III of England discovered, and as it should well have discovered since he was head of the Church of England, he discovered that that usury was a sin, and that by owing all this money to the Venetian bankers, he was engaging in a sin, and he repudiated his debts. And the whole thing came crashing down. The financial system came to a halt. Industry, trade, and agriculture basically ceased over Europe. You had probably Marcia knows a lot more about this than me in many respects, but you had a collapse of the entire agriculture-based European economy, which immediately resulted in the Black Death, the same Black Death which had first appeared in European history, as far as I know, at the collapse of the Roman Empire around the 6th century AD, or around there. The Black Death returned again to Europe and is estimated to have wiped out a third of the population of Europe, wiped out half the parishes in England. That is, the parish, nobody could afford to maintain those parishes anymore with the decline in population. So more could be said, but this was the great dark age of the 14th century. Edgar.
Yeah, let me. It's too tempting, but in the agriculture side, there are different things advanced, but it's even thought that in Eastern Europe, in other words, and even the high steppes, the northern plains or south northern plains in Eurasia, that certain agriculture practices were underway. As soon as they fell back, and also there was certain kinds of marauding and dislocation, what's the equivalent rodent of prairie dogs and others that are the vector,
the Black Death,
for the Black Death, for the is it
the plague,
ticks? The plague,
yeah,
the density of the fleas increase, and of course then they can travel in ships and other ways easily because there were so much more of them, and that gave rise to this. But it was directly connected to dislocation, agriculture collapse, and
starvation,
related.
Malnutrition, a whole thing. Also, as you say, what we have with the Okies and the depression, which we're getting now, which is the trooping of jobless unemployed from place to place throughout the country, all these things we're seeing.
Yeah, we have new now in Africa, in the Caribbean now, a new mosquito-borne disease, fever, and can be very virulent. Chikungunya, I think it's called, just in the last 12 months. And this is on top of dengue, on top of all the others. Exactly
AIDS.
The same
new
process.
Diseases, new worldwide killing diseases, AIDS, for one. If you're interested, I mean, Edgar Allan Poe portrayed this 14th century Dark Age right in London in a beautifully compressed way, I think, in a short story of his called King Pest, which it says very little explicitly, but what's implicit there is really everything I've said. Boccaccio's Decameron portrays exactly the same period, better known, I guess. Aesop's Fables in Greek, of course, was centuries earlier, but it portrays the Dark Age of Greece and the Aegean in the period of the first millennium BC and thereabouts. And we're in a dark age today. I mean, look at the situation of basic science. Now, Lyndon LaRouche has written tremendously about this in new ways, in new papers, including the one which is about to be posted, which we just discussed. But look simply at the fact that the progress of basic science in the world ended with World War I. I mean, some of it, that may seem strange to some of our listeners, but it's true. The great discoveries, Planck's quantum discovery was like 1899, 1900. Einstein's great discoveries were 1905 and then, say, 1912. By World War I, it was all over. There have been no basic scientific breakthroughs since. Again, some may debate that. I mean, there's some way to get questions in and stuff. Some may want to debate that, but it's true. There have been no fundamental scientific contributions since. It's been deliberately choked off. And Lyndon LaRouche, in recent papers, goes through the way that was done. And I just say briefly, I mean, one of the ways it was done was a program by the British imperialists, by Bertrand Russell personally, one of the top British imperialists, to make a ruling that henceforth all physical science, so-called, would be limited to nothing but arithmetic. This was a program laid out by a Prussian mathematician, David Hilbert, H-I-L-B-E-R-T, in 1910, and immediately followed up by Bertrand Russell, as in a total lie. But the purpose of the lie was to blacklist actual basic science. And that has been the case. And actually, I mean, talk about blacklist. I mean, the so-called McCarthy blacklists, which were really a feature of the British domination, the so-called McCarthy blacklists of science and scientists in the United States in the post-war period were part of the whole thing. So now the situation we have today is that people, scientists, genuine scientists, as LaRouche has said repeatedly, genuine, we know many of these people, many of them pretty old, but genuine scientists who believe in the prospects for extension of actual physical science as such are not allowed to work in the United States or in general in the transatlantic region. They're allowed to exist, you know, if they play by certain rules, which is not to say anything very much, not to talk too loud, but they're not allowed to actually carry on basic science. It's been outlawed. And so that's just an aspect. We could go through many, many more. But the other thing, which I'll just indicate, and many listeners are very familiar with this, I'm sure, is classical art. The same period, the death of Brahms, it's what, 1897 or 1900, what was it?
Around that time, might be 96, just, 98.
The death of Brahms, I've forgotten the date, but just around 1900. I mean, the death of Brahms was really effectively the death of classical composition in the Western world. So art, science. Now, I mean, you could go through a lot and we'll get to discuss it at other times, but what's going on? It's the same thing as that 14th century dark age. We're in the collapsed phase of empire, the decline and fall. I mean, as we've said, the British Empire, actually, that Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire was written as a project.
That's about 1790s, or when was that?
Was written as a project for Lord Shelburne, one of the pioneers of the British Empire. He assigned it as a project to Edward Gibbon so that the British Empire, which was then coming into existence, it was a little earlier in the 18th century, but the British Empire, which was then coming into existence, could model itself on the example of the Roman Empire. And it did so. It modeled itself on Gibbon's Roman Empire. And now, since 1900, we have the decline and the fall. It is now collapsing. The most obvious thing is the bankruptcy of Wall Street and all these associated Wall Street institutions all over the world, the City of London. They are completely bankrupt. There's no way anymore to hide their bankruptcy. They're coming down with a crash, and the vehicle chosen for that is what's called the bail-in, as we saw in Cyprus a year or two ago, where the bankrupt banks steal the money of the depositors in order to try to conceal their own bankruptcy and thereby trigger a catastrophic run, simultaneous catastrophic run against every bank. So it's kind of seppuku or harikiri for the financial system. That is where we are at right at this moment. Already it's been weeks, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, the European Parliament approved the whole law for bail-in in the European Union. It's not, because of various complications, it's not exactly in effect yet, but they approved it. So this is, and then Dodd-Frank enshrines bail-in in its provisions. So we are in the bail-in, we are at the period of bail-in, which means the period of the flash financial collapse. And it's this circumstance under which the top of the empire, the Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth, calculates the only way to survive is a war to subdue all the opposition, meaning mostly the opposition in Eurasia. I mean, the United States and Western Europe have been so degraded, our economy so degraded, that the, you know, the opposition here is much less than it would otherwise be. The Eurasia, Russia, China, their neighbors, have been permitted economic progress in this period. As a result, they're tending to advance economically. Here, the opposite. So the great war against Eurasia is the project, the British Empire's last-ditch project. This empire is collapsing, and as I tried to say earlier in different ways, its collapse can no longer be prevented. It's inevitable. The question is whether it's going to collapse on top of the inhabitants and bury us in the rubble, as happened in the 14th century. Today, in the thermonuclear age, the results would be even worse. They probably would mean the extinction of the whole human race as a result of thermonuclear war. That, at least as a sketch, as you look at these events in Ukraine, and we've described these events in the Pacific, they have to be seen against this background. This is where we are. And then, I mean, the other thing to go from here, if I can, I mean, is just to again, and something which most of our listeners are probably very familiar with, the question is, potentially, what do we as Americans represent? Because the forces, there's a need. If this situation is going to be reversed and if we're going to survive it, there's a critical need for U.S. leadership. First of all, just as there was in World War II. I mean, certainly the outcome of World War II was critically shaped by the U.S. participation in the war under Roosevelt. Similarly, the outcome of the current crisis, especially if there is to be an outcome for the human race, which we have to ensure, is critically dependent on what Americans do. Most immediately, because the British can't get that thermonuclear war without Obama. I mean, no matter how much they want a war, no matter how much they want to force the surrender of Russia and China, if Obama were removed from office, that would untie the knot that solves the whole puzzle all at once. Only with him in there is such a war possible at this time. And also, if he can be removed now, And in fact, if people do what they should, he can be removed now. If he can be removed now, the immediate result will be a tremendous outpouring of hope and optimism by Americans in a situation where upwards of 70% of them hate Obama. They would like to get rid of him, but they're suffering from a lack of the leadership to do it, a lack of the leadership to give them the confidence to do it. This goes to the issue of which again we've discussed on this program frequently over recent months. It goes to the issue of the question of empire as being the struggle of Zeus versus Prometheus. Going back to the play of Aeschylus, Prometheus Bound. This was part of a trilogy of which the first and last plays have been lost. This was the middle play. But the subject of the trilogy was that Zeus, which here represents exactly the same thing as empire, or the British Empire today, that Zeus had determined that the human race should be exterminated. And through, actually, very interestingly, just as the British in their population policy do today, that the human race should be exterminated not by Zeus killing them off personally, but through the factors of hunger, disease, lack of development, poverty, and so forth, that in this way they should be exterminated. Prometheus, the god, another god, as well as Zeus, a different sort of god, a titan, but Prometheus the god, out of sympathy, if you like, for mankind, gave them the tool by which they could avoid this population control extermination, or what we would today call the green policy of the British Empire, by which they could avoid being exterminated by the green policy or environmentalist policy being enforced by Zeus, which was fire. But the playwright Aeschylus makes it clear that what we mean by fire is not a natural phenomenon as such, but man's control of fire, through which man gained every further capacity in art and science. So, and again, on our LaRouche Pack website, we have numbers of studies of the concept of energy flux density, which go to the fact that that human development over the ages, going back way into prehistory, can be graded or can be measured by man's control over higher and higher levels of fire. In the first approximation, higher and higher temperatures of fire. So we've documented how the control, of higher and higher temperatures of fire is what has permitted man to engage in the increasing levels of metallurgy, from gold and silver to copper, bronze, iron, steel, through the hotter fires from, a hearth pumped by a bellows, the use of charcoal instead of wood, the use of coal instead of wood, the use of coke instead of coal, the use of petroleum, the use of natural gas, all these things allow higher controlled temperatures. And then to nuclear power with temperatures in an order of magnitude greater than simple fire. But again, these are not just, they're not just direct linear questions of temperature, because we also, in this revolution through fire, we expanded to the Benjamin Franklin's artificial fire, of electricity, the use of that over time and all this. So most of these things, of course, didn't exist in Aeschylus' time. But he was very clear about the process and what the gift of Prometheus is, which is really the creative fire of the human mind, as was Benjamin Franklin, who was called the Prometheus of the 18th century, famously, and Percy Shelley, who wrote his version of the lost third play in the trilogy, Prometheus Unbound, and Aeschylus, and you'll see if you read it, he saw it the way I'm presenting it, obviously expressed it a lot better, as an Aeschylus would see in the 19th century, the freeing of Prometheus through the ending forever of the British Empire, or the forms of empire which have culminated today. What we discussed in the dark age of the 14th century was the collapse into dust of the Venetian Empire. The Dutch Empire, unfortunately, arose through a process of genocidal religious wars. The Dutch Empire rose to replace it. The Dutch Empire moved its seat of government to London. And it's the Dutch Empire, under another name, that we suffer from today in the worldwide British Empire, which, as I say, is collapsing on us. So I guess I'd just finish up now, the British Empire, we have, again, on the LaRouche Pack website, we have a map. I think it may be also on the LaRouche Pub EIR website. We have a map of the British Empire, so you can see how much of the world is controlled by the British Empire, which is the largest part of it by far. If you take the various overlays, the countries where the Queen of England is head of state, the countries of the British Commonwealth, controlled from London, effectively, almost all of them, in the same way, the countries which are dominated by the London-based raw material cartels, Rio Tinto Zinc, Royal Dutch Shell, British Petroleum, the Seven Sisters, and so on. The countries which are dominated by the London financial empire, comprising the City of London with an offshoot in Wall Street, the Netherlands, Paris, Frankfurt, the other capitals I mentioned. So if you put this all together, you see the world reach of this British Empire now collapsing. And now, you know, in its eagerness to avoid its final disintegration and into nothing, threatening or immediately a war against Eurasia as a means by which they imagine they could stave off collapse a minute longer, even if the result is a world thermonuclear war, as we see now staring us in the face in Ukraine.
Right. Well, when you put it all top down, both historically and then you describe the contemporary, some of the apparatus, some of the manifestations, then it's no wonder you can see at any time the way you mentioned Chatham House gives you, okay, here's five ways you should taunt President Putin. Or we've seen this with the London Economist, all right, the publication, which is each week saying, Obama, you're nuts. You haven't. Here's what you have to do against Putin and Russia.
They say, Obama, the last Economist I saw, it was just a few days ago, they were saying Obama is a wimp, that the Allies suspect that Obama will not go to war, and therefore, you know, he's a wimp. That was the point of one of the inside lead editorials of The Economist. Is Obama the wimp who won't go to war? He's got to show that he'll go to war in defense of so-called allies, says the London Economist.
And this, another aspect of this, but just exactly in line with what you're saying about pestilence, starvation, lack of water, we could get into that or something, but lack of the means to life. Look at the drug wing of the apparatus you just described today. I mean narcotics, opiates, the legalization operation, you see it inside the United States. But internationally, I understand the volumes of heroin. It's produced in the Americas as well as in Afghanistan, et cetera, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have now a burgeoning, and I think many listeners are very well acquainted with it, probably to their harm or worse than, more than I am. But we have today a burgeoning heroin epidemic in the U.S., even beyond what we've seen in the past. So numbers of hospital admissions and numbers of overdose deaths have been, what I've been noting them on the East Coast, but I'm sure it's elsewhere as well, have been sharply increasing. And this is the British Empire's two opium wars against China. I mean, the British Empire conducted two opium wars against China for the freedom to addict Chinese people to opium. That was the subject of the two opium wars in the 19th century, that the imperial government of China attempted to forbid British importation of Indian-produced opium into China to create what became millions or tens of millions, one or the other, of Chinese opium addicts. And the British government twice went to war against China, sacked with and got other allies involved, sacked the city of Beijing, the capital, in order to force the Chinese to accept opium addiction. This is the British Empire of today, and this is the British Empire that arranged for Obama, a totally unlikely prospect with no known parenthood, no known birth, no passport, no nothing, and unheard of, two-year senator. One-term senator, I think he got 2 years out of it, in Washington, unknown, to make a speech at a Democratic convention and, wham, become president of the United States, not from nowhere. This was the British Empire, and it was done through the British Opium War against the United States, because what's now amply clear is that when Obama was running for his first term, he's running for the Democratic nomination against Hillary Clinton. She had the popular support. There was no question about that. She won the popular primary votes in the large states. She had the popular support. Where Obama was steered into the nominee was through very suspicious, non-popular primaries in the state of Texas. Now, which were very, considered very suspicious at the time. Now, what was going on was drug smuggling over the Mexican border. It's what's since been called,
there's the Fast and Furious.
Fast and Furious scandal. Mm-hmm. It's Obama's sponsorship and protection of these across-the-border drug smuggling things, which were used to accumulate the black money, unreported money, to get him the nomination, which then got him the presidency. And this was concealed. I mean, all this is probably obvious to many of our listeners. This was concealed under so-called internet contributions.
Oh, yeah.
Mass contributions of small amounts of money where the contributors didn't have to be accurately reported.
Because it was under the FEC requirement.
Yes. They just kept coming into the Obama campaign for some reason. And, what this was the drug money, and Obama has been returning the favor by increasing the amount of drug smuggling and the amount of drug money, which got him elected, along with George Soros, international drug czar, international drug smuggler, who was an Obama sponsor and supporter from an early stage. I think he first met Obama when he was a state senator in Illinois.
Well, one thing... One other aspect of this, we have maybe just 7 minutes left and so forth, but more of this comes out, although we don't have time to let, there's no, and nor should we think there's such a thing as history just unfolds and goes along. It isn't the way it works. But speaking of the walls closing in on Obama, I think there was a horror movie, right? Isn't this an image where the four walls are closing in on you, a nightmare?
Probably. It's also the Poe story,
Pit and the Pendulum. That's okay. But you have the, among other things, but back to the mother of this, the from Zeus to the, or the, in this case, the godfather of this empire, you have more attention now to the movie and the stories about the murder of Diana. Would you say something about that?
Yeah, I wish I had the title of it. But there was a movie, a documentary movie about the murder of Britain's Princess Diana, which directly fingered her husband, Prince Charles.
It's called Unlawful Killing.
Unlawful Killing. And it was made in what, 2011? It probably says right there.
Yes,
May 2011.
It was made
in 2011.
Film festival in Cannes.
Yeah, it was banned. It was banned in Britain, and it's banned in Britain today. But it is. But you can see it actually on our website. We have it on the LaRouche-Pack website, and you can see it elsewhere too. But it's a 2011 movie, Unlawful Killing, which indicates the responsibility of Prince Charles, Diana's then husband, and her father-in-law, Prince Philip, in her murder. So this has just come out, and it's obviously being widely viewed, and very appropriately so. I mean, this is, you know, just to tell you one of the most striking things from the movie, which I think was a new to this movie when it came out in 2011, was new to me when I saw it a week or two ago, is that there in the movie there were two specific warnings from Diana herself saying that her husband and or father-in-law, but I think actually her husband, intended to have her killed in a set-up automobile accident. And she described how such an automobile accident would be set up. So there were two warnings of her to that. They were both hidden from the coroner's jury, which is the main subject of the video or movie, is the coroner's jury. They were both hidden from the coroner's jury, which met to consider the causes of death. So that the decision of the coroner's jury was unlawful killing without further details, responsibilities. But, you know, if were not for the evidence hidden from them, they might have pointed more accurately the actual perpetrators. We have an upcoming feature in EIR, which is going to show the Prince Charles's responsibility for the September 11th, 2001 attack in the U.S. I mean, we've shown for several years that this was a British Saudi project. It was a project that the 9/11 attacks in 2001 were a project run out of London using Saudi Arabia. I mean, people should know, you know, almost all the hijackers were Saudi. The Saudi ambassador and his wife, it's been on the public record, they were both involved in sending money to the hijackers before the fact. A lot more has come out, which was hidden in the two investigations. So we're going to have a story in EIR, it's in process, which shows Prince Charles' personal involvement in the September 11th, 2001 attack. And this will help build momentum for what, again, I'm sure our users are familiar, our listeners are familiar with, or if they're not, they should be, which is the attempt to force the release of the 28 pages of the joint congressional report on September 11th, which pointed to the Saudi sponsorship of the September 11th attack. Those 28 pages were classified and not released with the rest of the joint report at the insistence of the Bush administration. When Obama was coming in as president-elect, he promised the families of the September 11th victims that he would declassify those 28 pages. Now he's been in there 6 years or so. He has refused to do it. So there is building momentum in Congress to force the declassification of those 28 pages. And as I say, our upcoming article showing Prince Charles' direct involvement in the 9/11 attacks should help get light a fire under Congress to declassify and release those 28 pages.
Yeah, and I'm glad to report that a few days ago, and the vote, I think, was May 6th, that Representative Walter Jones won his primary in North Carolina, who was one of the initiators of the live congressional bill that, along with a Democrat from Massachusetts, that would force through legislation the release of this 28 pages that's been kept under classification. And his opponent, Walter Jones, won by a good margin.
54%. He got 54%.
But an opponent thrown up against him was absolutely
parachuted in from Wall Street.
Wall Street money, big bucks.
$1.4 million parachuted into the district to defeat him.
Yeah. So, Tony, you've really given a great. It's everything is top down now. There are specifics that then fit in that, and they can be pivotal leverage, flanking opportunities when seen that way. It's just that this is not just any old panoply of things. The unlawful killing expose of the nature and function and record of the current empire. Various others of these things that are the nature of the witches' coven that forced the lies about the Benghazi killing of the ambassador.
Exactly.
It's the same people.
They're precisely the same people. And why would you believe them now on Ukraine after they lied the way they did on Benghazi? It's
right.
The same exact people.
So this is closing in. And so therefore what we can do, I don't need to motivate it. It speaks for itself. But for everyone to remember, in May, we do have the Senate remains in session. And from about May 12th to May 19th, the House is supposed to be back in his districts. We can really make that mean something. And we now are out of time today, but we have the Keisha Rogers campaign has been bringing out in one of the hottest races in the world in the state of Texas exactly the kind of nature of the enemy operation that the Tony Papert was just describing, and bringing out the solutions or the nature of. She's been issuing a call to action for people to become human again and think what we ought to be doing with NASA and with conceptualizing how to have water and rebuilding the economy. So I hope to have someone from the campaign.
Great.
She's too busy next Saturday. The vote is going to be May 27th. And keep that in mind and do everything you can, both for that and to change things in Washington. It is going to make all the difference in history. So this has been May 10th, 2014. I thank Tony Papert.
Thank you.
And we're closing out the LaRouche Show. Thank you.